Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, June 25th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital Medical Group, the multi-specialty practice of Saratoga Hospital, 27 specialty practices and more than 170 providers taking care of their community, saratogahospital.org. For more, joining us today is my favorite of all time, Dr. Nina Sachs, retired from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants. She started the health show and everything else. She's here to respond to your questions on all things involving the gastroenterological tract. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get your calls in early at 1-800-348-2551. I said it, I'll say it again, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Nina Sachs, your call's coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hi, everybody. Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Nina Sachs, one of my favorite people in the entire world, and I'm not kidding here, joins us today to respond to your questions on gastroenterology. Now retired from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants, Dr. Sachs received her medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine, completed her internal medicine internship and residency at Strong Memorial Hospital. She completed her gastroenterology fellowship at Albany Medical College. One time I asked her boss, Bill Notice, a long time ago, I said, you want to come on the radio? He said, no, but I have the right person for you. And he sent Nina, and she's been a good friend ever since. Dr. Nina Sachs, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
To join today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in with your questions and comments via email at voxpop@wamc.org or tweet us at WAMCVoxPop. I prefer you just call that number, 1-800-348-2551. Everyone has gastroenterological issues over the years, and we have the person to talk to you about it. Thanks to the wonderful Nina Sachs. Nina, I have an interesting question for you, I think, anyway. How many times do we have to have our colon looked at in our lifetime? Is it important to keep doing it?
Well, you know, we talk about average risk individuals in terms of risk for colon cancer. And one interesting thing is it used to be said until very recently that one should start in an average risk person. High risk being family history of colon cancer,
sure,
and other things. But average risk at age 50, and now that age has decreased now. The recommendation is now 45. So starting getting your first colonoscopy at age 45. And the reason is we're seeing a surge, actually, in colon cancer in young individuals, young meaning in their 30s. So that to take that into account, the age of onset of colonoscopy, your first screening, age 45 now. Mm-hmm. Some groups, perhaps even earlier, African Americans, perhaps at age 40, there's some movement in that direction because of risk factors. And then you asked me about how frequently, if a colonoscopy, a good thorough colonoscopy is normal, all right, and you are an average risk individual, we now talk about every 10 years for screening colonoscopy, and that's barring any unusual symptoms, okay? You just feel well, so 10 years. The time to stop colonoscopy, you know, I tend to individualize that because I see some people who are 75, which is generally the age we kind of think about, maybe that's your last one. But some people are very vigorous and perhaps should be screened older than that. So
Does the tissue get more fragile as you get
the
older?
The risk of colonoscopy does increase in the older population. because tissues do get more fragile. But you have to, it's always a risk-benefit analysis.
Sure.
So you really have to individualize.
Well, I don't mind the colonoscopies. I've had several in my life. What I do really mind is the PrEP.
Well, of course, but the PrEP is the most important part because you're now, see, colon cancer has changed over the years. Over the years of my practice lifetime, 30 years, it's really changed. You know, we used to see many more what we call polypoid or lesions that kind of come up from the surface. So they look like lollipops and you can they're quite visible and removable in some cases and so on. But now we're seeing, particularly in the right side of the colon, very flat lesions, very subtle changes. And those cancers are actually more aggressive.
And they have to be seen, which is why the PrEP.
Right. And they have to be seen. So if your PrEP is poor, you know, we're not going to see those subtle lesions.
Well, that's good. Listen, the phones are all lighting up, of course, 1-800-348-2551. So let's begin with our traditional first question from Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, real quick, go ahead.
Would you talk about the colorectal test that uses DNA, but gross blood will give false positives?
Yeah, I think I understood. So you're talking about the Cologuard, the
right.
The fecal test that utilizes DNA as a screening tool for colon cancer. This would be a non-invasive. It's not a colonoscopy, but it has excellent sensitivity and specificity as a screening tool for average risk individuals in terms of colon cancer. It is covered by Medicare. Some of the secondary insurances you have to always check are not covering it as yet, so you may end up with a bill. So you know that you have to kind of sort out.
So what is it exactly?
It's a test of the actual stool itself. So
yes.
You get a kit,
yeah.
And you
rub some of it on.
You poop and you take the stool and put it in the container and you send it back.
Oh, interesting.
But caller is correct. If you have gross blood, you could get a false positive. But that's with any of the fecal test, so the hemocult test, any of these types of screening that utilize stool for testing, you can get a false positive if there is blood.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Okay, now let's go to Barbara in Chester. All right, Barbara in Chester, you're on. Go ahead.
Hello. Doctor, both doctors, I want to know what causes ulcerative colitis, and what is the treatment?
Okay. Ulcerative colitis is an inflammatory disease of the colon, causes ulceration, inflammation, bleeding, diarrhea, weight loss. And we do not know exactly what causes ulcerative colitis. We know there are some genetic components. We now feel that it may have something to do with bacteria, with exposures when you're young. It could be viral. It could be autoimmune. But we really do not know exactly what causes it. There are some family tendencies, so we know there are some genetic factors.
But we know, Nina, am I wrong about this, that there was a while there that everybody drank milk and said, oh, well, we have to deal with this. And then all of a sudden the idea came along that you would start to treat it with antibiotics. Is that right?
Well, ulcerative colitis is more of, typically, you can use some antibiotics, metronidazole, Flagyl, for instance. You get some response with antibiotics. But the true treatment of ulcerative colitis moderate is really an aspirin cousin, azulfidine, for mild disease. And then for more severe disease, we can start with steroids. And then there are a whole host of other treatments, including antimetabolites and biologics, so like Remicade, Humira, things that we would treat rheumatoid arthritis with. So there's some crossover or psoriasis. So that there's a whole host of treatments with biologics now for ulcerative colitis.
Thank you, Barbara. Okay, now we'll go to Carlene in Saratoga Springs. Carlene, your turn.
Hello. Wonderful topic. The whole world's going to know about my
bowel habits.
Don't give your last name.
You almost got me, Alan. I have IBD or IBS, and I've had it for years, and it's been controllable. But 4 months ago, it started up, and it was really bad and intense pain, and up to 20 times a day going to the bathroom. So I've been confined to my house. I can't go anywhere. I'm ravenous, but I'm not losing weight. But what I'm really concerned about is if I'm so tired all the time, I'm wondering if I'm malnourished. And I've talked to 3 different dietitians and 2 different doctors, and nobody seems to think I'm malnourished, I guess because of my weight.
Okay.
Anyway, how can I find out exactly what I've got, and how can I find out if I'm malnourished?
Okay, so irritable bowel syndrome, it's probably one of the most common things I saw as a gastroenterologist. And you have what's called, it sounds like diarrhea predominant irritable bowel syndrome. And that is a tough one. It's typically diagnosed after we've ruled out many things. So if you've not had a colonoscopy and biopsies, you should. If you've not had an upper scope and biopsies of the duodenum, you should, because celiac disease, microscopic colitis, which is colitis that doesn't cause ulcers, it's underneath the surface. So microscopic or collagenous colitis can cause diarrhea. Bile salt malabsorption can cause diarrhea. And all of those things are treatable. Okay. So a thorough workup is needed. You also stool analysis, make sure you don't have a chronic infection, although it sounds like you've had this for many years, which kind of rules that out. Triggers, stress, food. I mean, I could go on and on and on. You really need to see someone like me, you know, see a gastroenterologist, have a thorough workup. And as far as malnutrition, you know, it doesn't. I don't get the sense that that's going to be an issue. Usually, with diarrhea predominant irritable bowel syndrome, it's more of a watery diarrhea, not a malabsorption. But we want to rule out some of those other things that can cause malabsorption of vitamins and nutrients.
Carlene, I'm so sorry, but we're up against a break here. We thank you for your call. Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye. All right, Zach, take it away.
Support comes from Patricia Dalton Fennell and AHMA, working globally and locally, announcing the Giving Circle, Afghanistan fundraiser project. Support helps young women in Afghanistan study to become teachers. AlbanyHealthManagement.com. Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York. Less than 50 minutes from Albany, offering minimally invasive procedures for back pain with Dr. Shen and Dr. Popper, NLH.org for more information. Wild Bird Junction Backyard Nature Shop, 308 Delaware Avenue, Del Mar. Offering wild bird seed, bird feeders, bird houses, bird baths, garden decor, chimes, binoculars, and nature and garden gifts. WildBirdJunction.com. Barrington Stage Company, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Presenting the timely, touching comic drama, The Cake, featuring Deborah Jo Rupp. Through July 15th, BarringtonStageCO.org. And from Travels with Sarah, organizing private African safaris with authentic tented camps and lodges, accompanied by Africa specialist Sarah Kearns, sarahssignaturesafaris.com.
Thanks, Engineer Zach, because we want to take as many calls as we can today. There are 3 people on the line. If you want to call, now's the time to call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And Nina, if it's okay with you, we'll go to Alexandra in Clifton Park. Alexandra, you're on.
Hi. My question is about milk. I've heard that once we're weaned, we really don't need milk as an adult anymore. And I know in like recent years, there's so many different alternatives, you know, almond milk and things like that. I just want to get your opinion on how much we need milk as an adult and if we should be drinking it. I know people drink it a lot still these days.
Okay. That's an interesting question. You know, I think so many people are intolerant to are intolerant to the milk sugar, lactose, that they've gone away from drinking milk and they'll drink instead either lactate, which is already pre-digested, or almond milk. It's very popular. But milk is an excellent source of protein, you know, per cup. 400 milligrams of protein per cup of milk. So that or a cup of yogurt, I mean, it's very healthy. So if you don't have lactose intolerance, you know, you feel comfortable in your gut after drinking milk, I see nothing wrong with milk. In fact, I think it's excellent.
Is there a relationship, Dina Sachs, between osteoporosis and milk ingestion?
Well, osteoporosis or lack of calcium, you know, milk is an excellent source of calcium. So when I said 400 milligrams, that's how much calcium is in a cup of milk. So it's an excellent source of calcium. Although I have to tell you, there's some controversy in terms of calcium supplements and osteoporosis, whether it actually prevents that. But natural calcium, such as in dairy products, are an excellent source.
Wow. Okay.
Is there a certain percentage that you would recommend that we should be drinking?
Like, well, you know, when you're thinking about milk, okay, so you're thinking about fat content, right, when you're thinking about percentage. So that's not the milk protein. That's the fat in the milk.
Okay.
So, you know, 4% would be whole milk and 2%, 1% in skim. So, you know, they say these days, you know, that we've gone too far into the low fat category, and then it's not satiating. So it depends on your weight, diet, cholesterol, all of those things.
Is there any problem with lactate, Nina?
No problem with lactate. And that comes in all different fat contents.
It does indeed.
Yes. So there's no problem with that. So you need to separate out, you know, milk as a good source of calcium and protein and the fat content. So if you drink a little less, you could drink whole milk. All right.
Thank you, Alexandra. Okay. We are ready for your calls. 1-800-348-2551. As you can see, we move right along. 1-800-348-2551. I'm waiting for you here. Let's go to Marilyn on the road. Marilyn on the road. Be careful there, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am 69, and I have had IBS-D since I was 18. I've kept it under control over the last 50 years as it's waxed and waned with diet, with symptomatic treatments, and so on. But 2 years ago, I began to have unrelenting diarrhea and have had it for over 2 years. Very recently, I found a gastroenterologist who did an upper and lower endoscopy and 12 biopsies to rule out any other cause. And then he's done something that no one else suggested before. He's put me on a drug called cholestipol, which is a bile acid salt sequester. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And I had my gallbladder out 20 years ago, but apparently there's a bile acid diarrhea that is caused and often occurs with people who've had their gallbladder out. This drug is working tremendously well for me. And I'm wondering if there are any long-term concerns with taking this medication, because I'll probably be taking it the rest of my life.
Yeah, you know, we did allude to that. Probably the first caller, and she talked about her IBSD, and we talked about bile salt malabsorption, and I think it's an interesting topic. It doesn't only occur in people who've had their gallbladders out, okay? It can be, sometimes it's what we call idiopathic. We don't know why this occurs, but the treatment is this cholestipol that you're on, which is a bile salt binder. The thing that you have to remember with this medication, since your symptoms wax and wane, the dose may change over time, okay? So I have some people taking it once a day or twice a day, and then things get better and they're taking it every other day. So the nice part of that, it's very flexible in terms of dosing.
Okay.
And I think the other thing to remember is it binds everything. So I'm sure your physician told you not to take your regular medications, vitamins, within a couple of hours at least of taking the cholestipol. So, you know, it just binds everything.
What does that mean, bind?
Bind so that it decreases fluid in the gut.
Right.
Okay. And then it will also bind, so it combines with other medications and prevents them from being absorbed.
Gotcha. Okay, Marilyn, thank you. And now we're going to go to Linda in Corinth. Okay, Linda in Corinth, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I've just been diagnosed, it's been a couple of months, with an adrenal gland tumor, and it's 3 centimeters, and they want to wait till it gets to 4 centimeters before they take it out, and I can't get anybody to tell me what the worst case scenario is. I'm worried about it spreading or something. I have no idea what, you know. Yeah, that's my question.
Okay.
What am I looking at down the road?
All right. You're out of my area a bit, okay, because that would be more of what an endocrinologist would do. But I would tell you that when we do CAT scans for other reasons, three-dimensional imaging of the abdomen, we often see incidental adrenal tumors. I would say that if you have not seen an endocrinologist, have you seen an endocrinologist to review your scan?
Yep.
And so they have already tested it to make sure that it's not secreting. Okay. And they're comfortable watching it?
Yep.
Okay. So you've kind of, that's kind of the way these things go. They're typically benign, but they watch for growth, which would signal that they're not benign. There are certain size characteristics, and your endocrinologist would know better than I what size. So they're talking probably about 4 centimeters to operate, and you're 3 centimeters. Mm-hmm. So it may stay that way for the rest of your life. It's hard to say, but you definitely need
be nice?
Yes, you definitely need to follow up with your physician. And you know what? If you're still concerned, you need to be asking them the question that you just asked me. I would call, and I would sit down and discuss that with your with a specialist. I really would. Okay, because you shouldn't be worried if it's not good to worry over things. You know, it's better to have the discussion, in my opinion, Linda, with a physician.
I agree with you.
Linda, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, now we're going to go to Tom in Hilton Head, South Carolina. I was there. Okay, you're on, Tom.
Hi, thanks for the call. I'm an old fan of your show. I used to live up in the Hudson Valley, but now located in Hilton Head. It's no
lucky,
snow here. But
lucky
anyway.
You.
Well, it's 99 degrees and humid, so we'll talk about that. I have a long history of aphthous ulcers, canker sores, and I also have a history of mild colitis. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to track this down. I've been working with doctors and did some blood work recently and find out that I probably have an autoimmune disorder, and that being what they call polyclonal gammopathy is the diagnosis from the blood work. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm trying to make some connections here. Is the aphthous ulcers a consequence of the colitis, a byproduct, kind of experience you have with, and they were severe. I mean, you really have to think before you swallow.
Yes.
Type ulcers.
Yeah. What you call extra intestinal manifestations of colitis or Crohn's disease. Typically, to be honest, apthy or these ulcers in the mouth are, especially the large painful ones that you're talking about, we see more commonly with Crohn's disease. So, but actually, if you said you had mild colitis, it could be Crohn's colitis. I don't have access to your particular history.
Sure.
Typically parallel the disease, you know, so if your colitis is active, your ulcers will be more active, but not necessarily. So people may have severe arthritis related to their colitis, and it's more active than the colitis, liver disease that's more active, and, oral apathy that are more active. So while they typically parallel the disease, they don't always. And, you know, oral apathy, if they're large, they can be treated. Have you had treatment for those?
Well, currently I'm on mild doses of prednisone.
Yes.
And they're gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because if that doesn't work, then there are injections of other remember I was talking about different types of treatment for colitis other than prednisone. So there are injection treatments for canker sores and so on, because these are not just little sores. They're quite painful.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us in South Carolina. Appreciate it.
Well, thank my friend Alexa. She connects me. But anyway, have a great
day.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks again. All right, that's funny. Now we'll go to Emily in Western Massachusetts. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
Hello, Emily.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to ask about just kind of chronic constipation, which I suffered for probably 10 years. And also, it seems my mother suffered it, and I think her mother before her. Mm-hmm. And I'm just a little concerned that I've recently seen there's a significant link between that and Parkinson's disease, which my mother also has, and her mother before. So I'm just wondering what you know about that. And also, if the other part of my question is, if there's like an autoimmune link between this, like the autoimmune diseases that people are having, is that linked to this leaky gut syndrome, and what your thoughts are on that?
Wow. Those are two difficult questions. So let's start with the constipation question. The fact that your grandmother, mother, and you all have constipation may indicate that the length of the colon, okay, so what you were born with, the length, is perhaps a little bit longer than usual, so that what happens over time, you know, all the waste products travel through our large intestine or colon, and water is reabsorbed in that area. And if the colon's a little longer, a little sluggish, that's what causes the constipation, the hard stools, difficult to pass, etc. So it's not uncommon for me to see people with severe constipation whose mother or grandmother also, and it's one of my questions that I ask. It doesn't change treatment, but it kind of explains things. Now, with Parkinson's, that's a degenerative disease. Parkinson's is associated with decreased motility of the colon. In other words, of the entire gut, actually. So things just don't move along as well. So that if you already have a tendency to constipation and develop Parkinson's, number one, the medications can slow the gut, and also there is a decreased motility in the gut, and that's why there's an association. But the fact that you have constipation does not mean that you're going to get Parkinson's disease on that basis, okay? You have a predisposition of family history, but it isn't really linked to constipation per se.
Emily,
do you follow me?
Yep, I do. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Emily. All right. And now we're going to go to Rosemary in Hyde Park. Rosemary, your turn.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, because I just heard a funny noise. I'm calling about a problem that began about 4 years ago, and for which I now take 2 doses of Imodium every day, one in the morning and one in the evening. And my problem is, I'm sorry to be so graphic, but it's when I had a bowel movement, it came out like molasses or some very thick, gooey substance. And it would go on like that. I'd have to sit on the toilet bowl for at least 20 minutes and sometimes a half hour. I went to a gastroenterologist, and I was tested for several food intolerances, and they all came back negative. I am lactose intolerant, and I was tested for that, although I already knew I had that. But I'm aware of the lactose intolerance, and I take lactate pills whenever I have dairy. So, any ideas?
Okay. Have you had a colonoscopy and biopsies?
Yes. As a matter of fact, coincidentally, I had a colonoscopy right around the time that this problem began, and I was completely clear. I had no polyps at all.
And did they do biopsies, or had you not really had this problem at the time that you complained of the...
Well, as I said, they started roughly... The colonoscopy was a regularly scheduled colonoscopy.
Yeah.
And the problem began right around that time. So, and then I also had an endoscopy.
Okay. So what I would ask is of your gastroenterologist, did they do small intestinal biopsies to rule out celiac disease? Did they do colonic biopsies to rule out what's called microscopic or collagenous colitis? Either of those could cause a change in bowel habits or diarrhea. Are you just moving your bowels in this manner once a day, or is it?
Well, with the two daily doses of Imodium, I have what I used to think of as normal bowel movements, you know, solid,
okay,
not messy.
All
and
right. Imodium is a mild medication for diarrhea. At the small doses you're taking, it is it should be safe. I would say other things to think about.
On a daily basis, it should still be safe?
It should be, but I think that there's got to be a reason for it. So I think you want to think about some other things. What other medicines are you taking? What's your diet like? Do you include sugar substitutes like Splenda,
which can cause
bloating and diarrhea?
No, I don't. I'm one of the lucky people that does not.
Right.
Crave sugar.
Right. And, you know.
And I eat a healthy diet, lots of vegetables,
okay,
lots of fruits.
Any increased stress that could cause more motility. So stress can play a role. So, I mean, these are the questions as a gastroenterologist that I would be asking. I do have patients after they've had a thorough workup, the kind of workup that we've been talking about, that do take Imodium every day, and it's acceptable because they can go out and do, you know, and live their life, and perhaps,
yes,
you know, there are fewer side effects with that than other medicines that we might be talking about. So I don't have a problem with that as long as you've had a thorough workup.
Well, As I said, I did these tests where I blow into a tube and then they check my breath.
Right, so you've had breath testing. It sounds like, and they've checked your stools. You're not on any suspicious medications. It sounds like your physician is doing a good job.
The only medication I take is a statin. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you, Rosemary. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back to George and Rob and James and Robert.
Support comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Kosak, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital. ACTSURG.com. Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. And from Luminary Media, a local full-service marketing agency and producers of Chronogram, Upstate House, Upstater, Explore the Hudson Valley, and more, LuminaryMedia.com.
We are back with the amazing Dr. Nina Sachs. So, Nina, somebody wrote me a note and wanted to know if you would answer about non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Well, that's such an interesting issue because now you look in the stores, everything is gluten-free.
Sure.
Gluten-free really has taken off. And only a very small percentage of people who are on a gluten-free diet have true celiac disease, which is an autoimmune phenomenon reaction against the gliadin, the protein in gluten, a certain protein. But so many people eat bread, eat gluten, quote unquote, and they're bloated. So the question is, what are they sensitive to? We don't believe it's gluten. So the schools of thought are that it could be that they're sensitive to what's called a fructan. So fructans are fruit sugar in a big chain. All right, so there's fructans in wheat, asparagus, a bunch of foods. So people who go on what's called a FODMAP diet, okay, so all these fermentable sugars are out of the diet. It's a complicated diet, but they feel better, less bloating, and that has nothing to do with celiac disease. So we feel that some patients with what we call non-celiac gluten sensitivity actually are sensitive to FODMAPs, to sugars.
Wow.
Okay, so it's malabsorption of sugars, gets into the colon, bacteria metabolize them, and the production of gas and bloating. There's another group that are probably sensitive not to the same protein as with celiac patients, but to another protein. So there is a whole school of thought and much research being done in terms of this, why people do not feel well after eating wheat. Okay, so it may not be that they'll respond to a gluten-free diet. So many of my patients don't. You know, they feel uncomfortable. They don't respond to that, but they'll respond to this other diet, the FODMAP diet.
Okay, we got a ton of people on the phone. From now on, you can call at your own risk whether we get to you is the question, and we have to move fast anyway. Let's go to George in Clifton Park. George in Clifton Park, let's go.
Hello, doctor. Thank you for taking the call. My question is a two-part question. One is probably an easy one. I suffer on and off from irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, and my doctor is a little hesitant to recommend outside of the normal drugs that are used to treat this, any natural remedies. Would you recommend any natural remedies for that? And then the second part of the question is, since IBS usually has something to do with the inflammation of the intestines, would that cause a platelet count to go up a bit?
Now,
thank you for a wonderful program.
Thank you. IBS, okay, irritable bowel syndrome. We're not talking about inflammatory bowel disease. So there's no inflammation. IBS, you look at the colon, it looks normal. Unless you have what's called microscopic colitis. So you do a biopsy and there's something underneath, okay? But the colon looks normal. You shouldn't, it would not explain increased platelets. That must have another explanation that needs to be sought out, okay? First of all. Second of all, there are many... You know, it depends on what your symptoms are. Are you diarrhea predominant, constipation predominant? But I'm absolutely not against, homeopathy or using safe natural remedies. Senna-T for constipation predominant irritable bowel syndrome is very effective. I mean, I could really go on and on. So if your physician, if you still have, symptoms, but you're feeling reasonably well and you want to go another direction, a naturopath, there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion.
George, thank you for the call. All right, let's go now to, James in Hudson. James in Hudson, you're on.
Hi, I'll try to be quick about it so people can get on. I have been diagnosed with an umbilical hernia. It seems to be very common in men my age, over 50. And I just want to know about what would be the three things I should avoid. And I'm worried, and there's a lot of talk about mesh or not mesh.
Okay. You know what? It depends. So an umbilical hernia is a hernia tissue that comes out of the belly button. And, some people have a small one. It doesn't bother them, and they live with that. Okay. In some it's large and there's a risk of twisting. Those are the ones that need surgery. As far as what type of surgery, I can't really comment on that because I don't do that type of surgery. I think you want to make sure that it's something that you need. Doing a lot of sit-ups.
It is definitely been diagnosed that one that will not get better by itself.
Okay. So you just need to see a competent surgeon. And I can't
I have a good GI. I like my GI. So,
perfect. So I really can't. I don't know, in terms of the technique, that would be something you would discuss with your colorectal surgeon.
James in Hudson, thank you for the call. All right. Now we're going to go to, we're going to go to Robert in Brandon. All right. Robert, you're on. Go.
Thank you both for covering this, and I want to start by saying I don't want to scare anyone away from colonoscopy. It saved my life. I'm 2 years out of a stage three colon cancer, ascending colon. They did surgery and chemo. And, of course, there's follow-up colonoscopies after that. I ended up not getting a ride, or my ride didn't show up in one of the procedures. I've already gone through the prep, and they offered me to go without anesthesia, which is where I learned how much pressure is pushed on the colon. Does anybody do that anymore without sedation? And I was also told two different things from my doctors. One is that 30% of polyps are missed on average. The other, that there was some abrasion from the colonoscopy instrument at times making that turn, and could that cause a polyp?
Okay. Abrasion making a turn would not cause a polyp. It could cause an abrasion, but not a polyp.
Okay,
so that's one question. We occasionally would consider doing colonoscopy if a patient, without conscious sedation, if a patient is so motivated. I would tell you when the studies are done in terms of doing colonoscopy without sedation, women do not do as well. Because their colons are more tortuous, difficult to do. They're smaller. They have pelvic organs. So technically, it's a little more difficult.
Right.
Big men, men tend to tolerate it a bit better. But it's not so much pressure. If you do a colonoscopy well, it's not so much pressure of pushing the scope. It's the pressure of the air that you introduce into the colon.
Absolutely.
To look at the walls of the bowel, because you want to do a really, really good look. So you do put some air, or now we utilize in our ambulatory surgery center, CO2. CO2 gets reabsorbed faster, so you don't quite have the same, the same bloating and so on.
Yeah, you always feel like you want to pass wind.
Right. So...
So is it pretty standard? I mean, does everyone fairly clearly they're qualified, but some people have a little heavier hand than others. Is that?
I would say that everybody has a slightly different technique, but if you've training, you do so many procedures that an excellent training program, you should be very competent to do the procedure. But it is an art.
I guess you can hear it. I'm just a little trepidatious about going back again. My CEA counts are all good. Everything has been fine for 2 years, and I'm expected in another. Three to have a recheck, and I'm just, I'm thinking Cologuard, some other means.
No, you're not a candidate for Cologuard because you've had colon cancer. So
yeah.
I would say that by the time you need another one, hopefully your fears, will have lessened, but do it.
Robert, thank you. All right, let's go to Rob in Pittsfield. Rob in Pittsfield, your turn.
Hi there, Dr. Sachs.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm 59 years old, and I've been diagnosed with IBS for the last couple of years, but for the past 6 to 8 months, I've had very obvious bloating, which I never really had before. I have a couple of gastroenterologists. One of them recently prescribed Zefan and dicyclamine. Do you know how effective those might be for bloating? And if not, what might be more effective for bloating?
Okay. May I ask what your original symptoms were when you were diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome? If it wasn't bloating?
Gas, constipation, some diarrhea.
Okay. So
indigestion.
All right. So gas and bloating to me are similar, but I guess the bloating is worse than usual. Is that...
It's been worse than usual for the last 6 to 8 months. Yes.
Okay. What I would say is, let's think about easy things. Look at your diet, sugar substitutes, any changes in your regular medications. All of that could be implicated. Are you eating more broccoli, beans, cauliflower, any gassy foods? So,
yes.
I mean, think about some of these simple things, okay, that may, stopping those may make a huge difference, okay? What your doctor's treating you for, I believe, is small bowel bacterial overgrowth. So too much bacteria in the small bowel that can cause bloating. It doesn't sound like you've had a breath test, but that's okay. We sometimes empirically, without that test, we'll treat someone for small bowel bacterial overgrowth. There are all kinds of things that you can do in terms of diet as well. And I would really kind of look at that and discuss that with your physician. Does that make sense?
Before the medication?
Well, have you started it? I mean,
I haven't started either yet. The Ziafen is cost prohibitive. It costs $1,400, but the dicyclamine I feel.
Yeah, that's easy. So what I would do is talk to your physician and say, you know, what are you thinking here? Why, you know, what else could I do? Is there anything else? And the other thing I would be thinking about, how old are you, sir?
59.
Have you had a CAT scan? Look at your pancreas. Just make sure that
I've had everything.
Everything.
I've had every test.
All right. Well, that's good. It makes me feel better when I'm giving advice. But you know, look at your diet too. Okay. Think about look up the low FODMAP. FODMAP.
Yeah, my gastroenterologist actually prescribed the low FODMAP diet. It's just very difficult.
It is difficult, but it works. And then what you do after you do that for a few weeks, then you gradually reintroduce foods and you can figure out what it is that's bothering you.
Okay, Rob, we got to go. Thank you. Nina, what about all those people who tell me that they bloat at night, but they wake up thin?
Because they're passing gas at night, they don't realize it because they're recumbent. And so when you're recumbent, particularly if you lie on your stomach, you'll pass wind.
Oh,
and,
interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay, now over to Jim in Burnt Hills. Jim in Burnt Hills, you're on.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. Quick question. I've been on Asafex or, you know, the similar type drugs for many decades, and I wanted to know what they know about long-term effects of being on that kind of drugs.
So tell us a little bit about it, Nina, about what this is.
I think that issue has changed over the years. Mm-hmm. And we used to really feel that these medications, which are called proton pump inhibitors, they're potent acid suppressors.
Sure.
And meds like Asafex, Prilosec, and so on. They're fine short term, and they're very, very effective for acid reflux. Very effective.
And a lot of people have been on them for their whole
and
lives.
And they've been on them for years. And I think what I do is I individualize. So I look at each patient because some people are put on them and they're never tapered off. And not everyone needs them for a lifetime. Okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe people need intermittent therapy or they can be tapered off and utilize a less potent antacid medicine. The reason I say that is I'm seeing more articles about perhaps potential side effects of long-term use of proton pump inhibitors.
Downside is?
I just saw one, depression. It's on the list of medications that may contribute. Now, these things come and go, these articles. So you wonder, is that true? Is it true? But again, I don't like to keep patients on medications that they may not need.
Well,
now,
you don't
just stop Asafex, particularly if you've been on it for years, because if you just stop it suddenly, you'll get what's called acid rebound. So you'll get more gastrointestinal symptoms. So you want to taper it and see what's the lowest dose. What's the lowest dose that I can take that solves my problem, or can I taper off and use it as needed intermittently? That's what I would discuss with your physician. Obviously, I would discuss it with your doctor. I wouldn't just do that.
Okay, Jim, thank you. All right, let's go to Carol in Western Massachusetts. All right, Carol, your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm glad to talk with you. I have a question about a recent incident, prefaced by the fact that I have interstitial cystitis and have also been diagnosed as having mild colitis or Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. The evening that I'm speaking of now, I had had a dinner in a restaurant, and about 4 hours after that, it was a very simple kind of meal. About four hours after that, I started having diarrhea, and I was also having vomiting for 4 or 5 hours. I can't tell whether or not I got food poisoning.
Okay.
Or whether or not it was just the usual thing.
We're running out of time, I'm told. So let me just say, something that happens, you eat in a restaurant, 4 hours later, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, sounds to me like a foodborne illness. Okay. So typically that's a staphylococcal food poisoning. It could be other bacteria, but that does not sound to me you know, it could be what you'd call acute colitis, okay, something that happens quickly, you know, food poisoning, but it doesn't sound like inflammatory bowel disease or an exacerbation of your basic GI problem.
Okay.
It's because of the suddenness, the timing. The timing suggests foodborne illness.
Well, thank you very much there, Carol. Very quickly on line number 8, Dale, if you can't answer your question in a half a minute, in a half a sentence, you can't stay on. Go ahead. What do you got? What do you got, Dale?
Oh, a GERD I have is actually, I want to know what causes the valve to fail, and is it permanent?
Okay. Gastroesophageal reflux, or acid from the stomach into the esophagus, is one of the most common things I see. And the sphincter, the muscle, some of us have a weaker muscle. Sometimes it develops over time, but it's such a common phenomenon.
Yeah.
Such a common phenomenon.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. We're out of time. Thanks to Dr. Nina Sachs for joining us today. Nina, we all love you, and we remember all your help for WAMC, and you're terrific. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to those left on the line. Support for the Medical Monday comes from WAMC Heart and Vascular Institute, with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals. Members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell, also incomparable. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.